Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today is a New York Times best-selling author who is also an award-winning screenwriter. Chris Enns has written for television, short subject films, live performances, and for movies. She's done stand-up comedy and works as a stunt woman. She learned the basics of writing for film and television at the University of Arizona and has written more than 30 books about women of the Old West. I'll be asking her about the deaths and burials of the Old West's most nefarious outlaws, notorious women, and celebrated lawmen, whose touching, exciting, and tragic stories she tells in her book, Tales Behind the Tombstones. Next Wednesday evening, Chris Enns will be appearing at the Patrick Ranch Museum in Durham, talking about women of the Old West, from mail-order brides to ladies of easy virtue. Chris Enns, welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I'm excited to chat with some of the folks that are no longer with us, but their legends live on.
They are legendary, and I just got such a kick out of reading the stories of these people, because some of the stories of people I knew, I learned something that I didn't know about them, and then the ones that I didn't know, I found, wow, what an interesting person.
Well, I enjoyed writing this book about these Western characters because we know so much about how people like Calamity Jane and Elizabeth Custer lived. We just don't know much about how they died. And I found it fascinating to research that aspect of their passing. And this book is a lot of fun because it's just bite-sized little morsels that will give you a little, it's kind of very Paul Harvey.
Yes, I did think of that. I really did. And here's the rest of the story.
Right, exactly. And some of my favorite ones are people like Buffalo Bill Hickok, Buffalo Bill Cody, who when he passes away, and there's so much controversy about whether or not he's going to be buried in Cody, Wyoming, the town that he helped helped build and that it was named after, or Golden, Colorado. It's a great deal of controversy about that. He is buried in Golden, Colorado. But when he passed away, people were concerned that someone would come and disturb his gravesite. So they, the governor of the state at the time issued that an armed tank be placed at his grave until his wife passed away and she could be buried with him. Mm-hmm. I thought that that was a really fascinating tidbit about Cody.
Well, you know what else I found interesting about Buffalo Bill Cody is the ad that he answered for the Pony Express. Do you remember what they were looking for, what they said they were looking for a Pony Express employee?
Boy, I just know that they were looking for somebody that was strong, willing to ride long bouts while traveling through the West, someone that was incredibly daring. And do you have the exact quote right there?
Yeah, they said wanted young, skinny, wiry fellows, not over 18, must be expert riders willing to risk death daily, orphans preferred.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Now, Cody was not an orphan, but he certainly was someone that could ride with the best of them. That's what fascinated me about Cody, because by the time he is 14 years old, he's already a legend. I mean, he's already ridden with the Pony Express. He's already gone west and helped be a scout for the different military expeditions that go west. I mean, he is just a very well-accomplished young man. And there's almost two parts to Cody's life. There's that early teen years where he does all he does, but we always think of Cody with regards to the Wild West show, and he was so much more than that.
Yeah.
I got a kick out of Hickok, too, Wild Bill Hickok, who was shot, of course, in 1876 in Deadwood, South Dakota, and just knowing that he was too a gentleman who was very well accomplished in his life in his younger years, doing all that he did, but being in Dakota with his eyesight nearly gone, and mining. He went out there to be a gold miner, and I just thought that it was just a fascinating life. And then he ends up being shot in the head in 1876.
Yeah, well, when you were talking about Wild Bill Hickok, he apparently wasn't as taken with Calamity Jane as she was with Wild Bill.
No, that's always. But, you know, I mean, she started telling a lot of the tales about Hickok after he had passed away, and you know, dead men tell no tales. So, yes, Calamity was a fascinating individual. They came into Deadwood at roughly the same time. They knew one another. But they didn't, and they were acquaintances and possibly friends, but they weren't really as involved as she would like to have people believe. She was, I believe, terribly in love with Hickok. I mean, her last request was to be buried next to Hickok, and she is indeed. But I thought that her funeral service when she passes away was a fascinating point to focus on too. And she's laid in state in a white dress, and how upset the people of Deadwood are that this woman who was always in buckskins and leather and carrying weapons, she didn't have any weapons on her person, and she was in a white dress. People were outraged about this. As they passed by to pay their respects, they started putting weapons on her. But things started getting out of hand because they started taking pieces of her dress and pieces of her hair. They had to fashion special wire, special chicken wire, around her frame so the service could continue without anybody disrupting her body.
My guest is Chris Enns, and we're talking about stories from her book, Tales Behind the Tombstones, The Deaths and Burials of the Old West's Most Nefarious Outlaws, Notorious Women, and Celebrated Lawmen. And you know what I kept thinking, and Chris, I don't know if you're old enough to remember a movie in 1953, I think it was, where Doris Day played Calamity Jane.
Oh.
And when I read about the real Calamity Jane, I thought, oh, heavens, what miscasting. Wholesome Doris Day playing Calamity Jane?
Well, I think Calamity would have wanted it that way. I mean, she was always, it was always difficult to determine with Calamity what was truth and what was fiction. But Calamity was, I mean, she was an alcoholic, and certainly Doris Day wasn't. You didn't see any of that in Calamity Jane, which, by the way, is a fabulous movie. I mean, it's very athletic. Doris Day just dances her socks off in that film. But it was certainly a lot of fun to find out how different Calamity was from anything that we would see in the movies. I mean, she did help people who had smallpox, and she was very good at being able to help anybody who was in trouble. But she herself couldn't recognize when she was in trouble and got help. She was she drank an awful lot. She cursed with the best of them. And
in fact, you quote in one of your other books called Wicked Women, she was the champion swearer of the Black Hills of Dakota.
I know. That was something to be said, because there were laws against swearing in Deadwood at one time. I mean, it was really a raucous place. If you've ever seen the television series Deadwood on HBO, certainly they did a good job of making Deadwood be exactly as it was. So.
Well, another thing, her favorite vices besides drinking, and they were related, was poker. And apparently she'd get people to buy her drinks by telling all these stories that may or may not have been very true. But she also was a poker player.
She was a poker player, but not a very good poker player. She did ask for people for drinks, and they would buy her rounds, and she kept playing. I mean, and her stories, she had such a great way of being able to tell a yarn that I think people held on to those stories and wanted to know more about her. I mean, she also was a part of Cody's show, if we could harken back to Cody for a moment. Mm-hmm. I mean, the two of them worked together in his show in New York at one point. And he knew her and saw that she was down in her luck and gave her a job in his show. She didn't last very long. She wasn't somebody who wanted to stay put for very long. But the way that a lot of these lives in the Old West intersected, I thought was really amazing.
Yes, that they actually did know each other. Some of these characters, these legends that we hear of, actually did know each other.
They did know one another, and they were in the places. Just, I mean, Hickok and Cody were very good friends. They were scouts. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, Hickok was one of Cody's first actors in the Wild West show. It was three men, and Ned Buntline is the one who put them all together. Buntline was a great promoter of all things Western, and he put them together to do this program to let people know what the Old West was like, because they saw it fading and wanted to be able to perform different stories about the Old West, and that was their first show. So it would be Hickok, and it would be Cody sitting on stage with another gentleman talking about the Old West.
My guest is Chris Enns, and she has written more than 30 books about women in the Old West, and one of her other books, we've been talking about Tales Behind the Tombstones, but your book, Wicked Women, Notorious, Mischievous, and Wayward Ladies from the Old West, and Calamity Jane is one of the women pictured on the cover of Wicked Women, and there's Poker Alice, and boy, does she look tough. I mean, she's an older woman, got gray hair, with a cigar in her mouth.
Well, and she definitely...
Calamity Jane also smoked cigars, you say.
she was a tough woman. I mean, she was... She ran her own gambling hall, and of course, when I say gambling hall, you also had your faction of soiled doves in those gambling halls, and yeah. It was a tough place to be in charge of, and you always get the idea of a person in charge of, or the madam in charge of a soiled dove house is looking a lot like Miss Kitty from Dodge City. And certainly Poker Alice looks nothing like that.
But,
when she was younger, she did carry herself very well and wore fine clothes and had her hair done up. But as time got on, she just preferred to wear sweaters with holes in them. And the part of her costume that never changed was the guns that she wore. So she was not afraid to take on anybody who came in and caused a problem in her business, and definitely shot a couple of people in her lifetime.
Yeah, these women, as you described them, most of them I wouldn't want to mess with because they were really tough. But you say in the 1870s, you write, more than half the working women in the West were, and there are these euphemisms, soiled doves, sporting women is another word for these prostitutes. And some of them, I was surprised at how many people were tall, like Mary Fields, Stagecoach Mary, was a black woman, and she was a mail carrier at age 60. She was 6 feet tall, and she would be a tough woman. And, of course, Calamity Jane was tough. Carrie Nation, my goodness.
Carrie Nation was someone that I thought, who knew that Carrie Nation, you know, the proponent against alcohol, and was always going into different saloons with her axe and busting up saloons or busting up a still. She was married to, her father was an alcoholic, and she was married to two alcoholics.
But you know what, though? I still think, I mean, it's in spite of that, that when she, there's a quote that you have from 1887, Carrie Nation, "Men are nicotine-soaked, beer-besmirched, whiskey-greased, red-eyed devils." I thought, boy, all men are that way in her opinion. I mean, I could see if she had a bad experience with her father and her husband's, but good grief.
Well, I think that's what she based a lot of this on, both her father and her two husbands. And being out and about and seeing what she did and how men behaved after they'd had a lot to drink, they were either shooting at the town, and a lot of them frequented these houses of ill repute, which, again, she found quite distasteful. And wanted to. She was against everything that would happen after you had a few too much to drink. Mm-hmm. She wanted it to be arrested, and she was not opposed to making a show for herself and making a name for herself, too. I mean, she went on to be in vaudeville after she got a reputation as someone who would walk into saloons and cutting them up with an axe. I mean, she went on the vaudeville circuit.
And she was a big woman. I mean, she was 6 feet tall, but she was also not a skinny woman either. So she could, she had plenty of weight to throw around.
No, she liked pie. It was very evident that she liked pie. So I thought that she was just always wore black taffeta, always had the bonnets on. I mean, she had a definite persona that she kept and maintained. And there were just so many women of the Old West, well, men too. I mean, Hickok was one of the best-dressed men in the Old West. People wanted to dress like Hickok and Cody. Cody wore those boots that came way over his knees, and Hickok wore the red sash with his guns fastened the reverse of what everybody else had, their guns.
And what about General Custer?
Oh, boy, General Custer. I mean, he certainly was a man who didn't do what anybody else would have done, and it came down to fashion, too, with that. I mean, he had not only did he have his own uniforms made, but he also was responsible for the look that his wife Elizabeth Custer had. He was so appalled once when they were on a parade grounds during an inspection of the troops that a gust of wind came and blew Elizabeth's skirts up, and you could see her petticoat. He was appalled by this, so he designed clothing for her where they had lead bullets in the bottom of her gown, so it could never go up again. But he combined this look of military with her long coat, her long skirts, and it was a unique look for her. And
in fact, in reading about her, I really liked Elizabeth Custer. She was quite attractive, and she maintained her role. I mean, a lot of these women were pretty tough, but she seemed to enjoy her role as a woman, as a wife. And I was touched by the fact that when she learned of her husband's death, her first thought was to go out and help the other wives who had lost their husbands.
Well, I mean, she was an officer's wife, and that's what they would have done. And I thought that that was quite heroic of her as well, because she was visibly upset when she was told that Custer had died. And she did go and make her rounds to pay her respects to these other women. She wanted to be the one that told them. But she was quite tough, too. Even though she was very much
a
lady, she was one of the first women to go into the fields with her husband and live on the plains as he was traveling about. She didn't want to be apart from George. So it was not uncommon that she wrote a couple of books about tenting on the plains and living with George in on the plains and being with her brother-in-law, wearing their boots so snakes wouldn't get in. Seems very much like Toy Story. There's a snake in my boot.
Well, of course, most people know that General George Custer was killed in the Battle of Little Bighorn. And it was so, the words that this, Captain William McCaskey is the courier who came to notify Elizabeth the next day. And his words I just read them several times. None wounded, none missing, all dead.
Well, there were so many times that Custer was in the field and there would be rumors that he had died. He had instructed Elizabeth to only believe that particular message. And in those three sentences, was made completely clear to her that there was no mistaking this. I found it fascinating that she never did go into Montana. Mm-hmm. We always think that she might have paid her respects at the Custer's last stand, but she never did go there.
Well, I think she probably could believe what the courier said, too, because I think she had a premonition, didn't she?
Yes, she did. As they were riding away and she saw the flags and heard the music of Gary Owen, she just knew that something wasn't going to be right, that this was going to be the last time that she would see him. And she held that in her heart. She didn't share that with too many people. And she just was an incredible woman to maintain her belief in Custer after everything, because people, of course, said that he was at fault completely for what happened. And she took his men that were directly under him, both Reno and Benteen, to task for for any bad that they ever said about him.
My guest is Chris Enns, and we are mainly talking about her book, Tales Behind the Tombstones, to the Deaths, Burials of Old West's Most Nefarious Outlaws, Notorious Women, and Celebrated Lawmen. And you do also have, you've written a lot of books, and one of them about Elizabeth Custer. And one of them, the women, you've written a lot about women. One of the women that I didn't realize how much I would admire, and that's this very young woman who came out with Bidwell. Now, John Bidwell is very well known in Chico. There's Bidwell Avenue, Bidwell Streets, Bidwell Mansion. But there was a member of Bidwell's group when he was coming over the mountains into California, and her name was Nancy Kelsey. And I love this quote that somebody said about her, about Nancy. She bore the fatigues of the journey with so much heroism, patience, and kindness that there still exists a warmth in every heart for the mother and her child. She came with a baby, and she was just a youngster herself.
Isn't that amazing? She makes this heroic journey from, we can say the starting off point is independence. She goes all the way from independence to the Sierras,
Missouri.
Makes that trip barefoot, carrying a one-year-old baby on her hip.
She's only 18.
Only 18 years old, and the only woman on the Bidwell Bartleson wagon train party. It was really interesting. When I was doing the research about her, I really wanted to find out what her first name was. Mm-hmm. You have to go digging quite a bit to find out that her name was Nancy, mm-hmm. and that's only in some of the journals that the men write, who say when they felt that they couldn't go on, they would look at the end of the trail, and they would see Nancy, and they felt that they could keep going one more day. Mm-hmm. They did get lost in the Sierras, and they left her in one of the caves with the baby and a gun and some food, and they said that they would return once they found their way. They did return, but she was left there for a week with that child. But it was fascinating. The baby never got sick a day.
Yeah, she was just 18. She was barefoot with a baby, and she was the first white woman, you say, to cross the Sierra Nevada mountains.
Right.
But she was such an inspiration to her fellow travelers, like the guy, this happened to be Joseph Childs, that wrote about her heroism, her patience, and her kindness.
Well, you'd have to be patient to go along that way with a baby. Goodness.
Well, there's also a woman who is in your book, and people didn't know she was a woman. And I know this happened during the Civil War, that women would dress as men if they wanted to participate in the Civil War. But there was a guy that people called Charlie Parkhurst, and Charlie started out life as Charlotte.
Well, and you know, it's what's interesting about women like Charlotte that came west. I mean, they would come with their fathers or their brothers, husbands, and when they got west during that journey, their family would have passed away. When they got out here, what were they going to do? They couldn't turn around and go all the way back. It was a long way back, and so they had to find a way to make a living. Charlotte was a freight wagon driver. She loved to do that and knew that she was not going to be able to get work as a woman doing that. So disguised herself as a man for several years, even wearing a patch over one eye, and was this driver of freight wagons through the Sierra Nevada foothills. And 67 years old, another cigar smoker. How about that? We're talking about ladies who smoked. She was another one of those. It just went with the whole look.
I mentioned that there's a village, well, Kelseyville is named for Nancy Kelsey,
mm-hmm.
and Winnemucca, people wonder about that name, Winnemucca, and there was an Indian woman, Sarah Winnemucca, who was the first Native American woman to write a book. That's impressive.
Yes, she was very intelligent and very much a peacemaker for her people. I mean, she would strive to be able to make sure that people got along in a time period where, definitely the Bannock Indians in the Paiutes in Idaho and Oregon were battling it out. And she would be that go-between because she was knowledgeable and could speak English and was well-read. And, didn't hurt the fact that she was really beautiful.
Well, and you say that by the age of 14, she spoke five languages.
Yes, isn't that amazing? I can barely master the one.
Well, and then speaking of place names, Winnemucca, but her grandfather was Chief Truckee. And so there's another place name that we learn in your book.
Everything, history just intersects itself.
Well, some of the men in your book, now we've kind of focused on the women because they're less known perhaps, but Jesse James is a well-known name, and I thought it was interesting that the guy who shot Jesse James was referred to as the dirty little coward who shot him. Bob Ford.
Mr. Howard, yes.
Yeah.
And you know what's remarkable about that is when I went to take pictures of Bob Ford's gravesite, which it's not much of a gravesite, it is just a rock for the most part, there were flags and signs around it that said just that, the dirty little coward that shot Mr. Howard. Jesse James was a beloved folk hero in that part of the country, someone that stood up to the North and Banks, and certainly in that in Missouri at that time period when James was so popular, people wanted someone to stand up and be an advocate. Even though he never robbed from, he never gave anything to the poor, and he was a killer. That part is overlooked.
But it was a cowardly way that Bob Ford shot him.
There's no question about it.
Well,
but I think that, you know, Jesse James himself wasn't opposed to shooting somebody in a cowardly way.
Well, these men really wanted to die with their boots on. That's why we have so many cemeteries named Boot Hill. You say there are 10 states have at least one Boot Hill. But Doc Holliday died in bed. He wanted his boots, but he didn't get, he always insisted he was going to die with his boots on. He didn't get to do that.
Right.
Doc Holliday is another fascinating character. But you know what? I want to, and I'm sure people may have heard this from other sources, but this is so clever, and that is how the grave of Lester Moore was marked. Can you quote that?
Golly, I think it's, "Here lies Lester Moore, shot with the 44, no less, no more."
Yes.
I think that that's, if memory serves me correct, isn't it? And that's from the Tombstone Cemetery, too. I mean, they have... I mean, that's very well preserved as well. I mean, that's something, as you're going along doing this book on Tales Behind the Tombstone, to go walking through these tombstones and to see an epitaph like that.
Here lies Lester Moore, four slugs from a 44.
Okay.
No less, no more.
Okay, there it is.
So you will be at the Patrick Ranch Museum next Wednesday. And you'll be talking about women of the Old West, from mail order brides to ladies of easy virtue. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Chris.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, and I'm looking forward to meeting everyone. Thank you.
Chris Enns is the author of Tales Behind the Tombstones and Wicked Women. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.